Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, America. You're tuned to A Just Cause Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman, your host, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. My co-host is Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. How you doing tonight?
Hey, doing good, Sam. Doing good.
Ready to tell it like a TIS.
All right. We got a good show tonight. We got in the studio, we're going to have LaWanna Clark, who was wrongly convicted. And we'll talk about how her case is tightly woven with the IRP 6 case. Also, dialing in a little bit later, we're going to have Judith Housley, who is a board-certified forensic document examiner, who examined some of the documents and did some analysis in LaWanna's case, which would have exonerated her if her attorney had presented it during the trial. So we'll dive a little bit more into that a little bit later. Callers, document this number. Write it down, 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. If you'd like to call into the program and participate, you can make comments, ask questions, or what have you. Okay, our usual thing, got to give this disclaimer. Cliff and I are not attorneys, and A Just Cause Coast to Coast is not a program that provides legal advice. Please contact your legal professional for specific legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed during this program by the guests do not necessarily reflect that of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast. But as always, we're excited that you chose to join us as we dive into compelling and insightful dialogue about judicial injustice. We're going to have some good discussions tonight. Again, this is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. So, Cliff, what's going on in the news and so forth?
Well, today in the news, I didn't get a chance to look at that much, but I know that Ethel was looking into some things that she thought were very interesting. Ethel, if you want to go ahead and share what you found today.
Actually, I was looking at an article, you know, talking about who police prosecutors, you know, that abuse authority. And the actual case that I was looking at, a case about a gentleman named Tony Bennett. Not that Tony Bennett. I know what you're thinking. Not that one.
Okay.
But anyway, this is a gentleman that lived in New York, Jamaica Bay, New York, served 13 years in prison for a murder that he did not commit. And all based on this same kind of stuff with the prosecutors withholding evidence.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of becoming one of those big things out there, you know, with the prosecutors withholding evidence. And I remember, I think we were talking about in LaWanna's case where her lawyer withheld evidence in her case, wasn't it?
It was evidence that would have cleared her. And that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit later on, where we talk about the handwriting expertise and all that kind of stuff. And Judith Housley, she's going to be talking about, you know, what goes into doing handwriting analysis and how that would have played.
Right.
I mean, that would have been a pivotal point in LaWanna's case.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that just, you know, gets under your skin when you start thinking about that kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
And that was a defense attorney. I mean, you know, in LaWanna's case, you were talking a defense attorney.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on out there when you talk about prosecutors.
But, you know, I think the thing is, too, it's like it's not just one side that's doing it. It's both sides that's doing
that's
it.
That's right. That's
that
right.
Stuff is getting ridiculous. Who do you trust these days?
That's right.
Right. And we always, you know, say, hey, you got to hold the prosecutor and the judge accountable, you know, the whole judicial system
right?
when they do something wrong. But we have to always understand that, especially when you have a court-appointed attorney,
mm-hmm.
that you have to know who it is that's representing you.
Yeah.
And when the person is representing you, you still have to step in and you have to be involved. Otherwise, you can find yourself at the end of a prosecution where your attorney, your defense attorney,
mm-hmm.
sits back and pretty much sets you up
yeah.
and hands you over to the prosecutor. And these are the type of things that, you know, it shows that across the board,
mm-hmm.
the whole judicial process,
right.
the whole system is sick from the
it
head
stinks.
Down, and the head needs to be chopped off.
It really does.
And there's this one case that I heard, I think it was on 48 Hours, and
mm-hmm.
it was a guy that got exonerated. We'll look into that one, but
right.
Where he was acquainted with his court-appointed attorney
mm-hmm.
20 minutes
Oh my goodness!
20 minutes. For those of you who don't, whose radio or computer doesn't have a screen on it where you can see Cliff,
20 minutes,
2-0.
His eyebrows just went halfway up his head. 20 minutes, Cliff.
Oh my God!
And he met his attorney 20 minutes before his trial.
Now, how do they say that? Okay, and that's what gets me about the U.S. justice system, our judicial system. They say, okay, your constitutional right is you have a right to have an attorney represent you during this trial. If you cannot afford one, we'll appoint one for you. But you appoint somebody who shows up 20 minutes before you stand in front of a judge. And what do you think this person is trying to get you to do? Guarantee that public defender said, hey, what plea do you want to make?
But
that's
then,
right.
Don't, because don't they tell you about something about effective?
Right.
Effective?
You're supposed to have effective counsel. Well, I'm effectively going to hand you over
I'm
to the
hand
prosecutor.
You right on over.
How much time do you want to do? Let me know
exactly.
Right now.
And then, unfortunately, after someone sits in prison for 10 years, then they come back and they say, well, yeah, we're going to exonerate him based on ineffective counsel. You know, it's like, no, that should have been,
crazy.
You know, up there at the very beginning. Hey, one story I saw in the news that I think, you know, would be interesting, and it's because of the fact that we've been reaching out to this man for months. Mm. And so, you know, the House right now, the House GOP, they are planning on impeaching Attorney General Eric Holder, and they're saying by the end of the year is what they're going after. And you know, the only other time that a cabinet member has been impeached, 1876, when the House impeached the Secretary of War, William Belknap, for corruption allegations. Now, Belknap, he resigned like, you know, minutes before the House voted on him. Now, you know, the irony here is that I think you guys probably heard in the news that I think Holder has been talking about he might leave his post by the end of the year.
Right.
So, but, you know, the GOP, they're saying they're going after him. Now the way
they gonna have him leave
remains to be seen. In Belknap's story, it ended up with the Senate holding a trial, and he was acquitted of all charges. Again, this was back in 1876. But you know, when you look at this, Ethel, and as far as executing his office, and I know you know recently Eric Holder came out and he gave several million dollars to release several million dollars to. Help the defender side of the House. But still, in our situation with the IRP 6, you know, what's been going on with that, Ethel?
Look, your guess is probably as good as mine when it comes to Eric Holder, because he hasn't done a cotton-picking thing with the IRP 6 case. All we know is, you know, we have like a group of over 30 people who reach out to Eric Holder's office on a daily basis.
Right.
And I know I have spoken to one person there who has told me because she's really tired of us calling, and they know my voice. I mean, my name is one thing, but my voice is something. So they even know my voice now when I call. So it's like, well, Ms. Lopez, you know, Mr. Holder already knows what's going on with this case. And well, my question, honey, is why hasn't he said something?
Exactly.
You know, why hasn't he reached out to us or reached back to us to tell us, you know, I understand what's going on. You know, I'm going to look into it, something. But he hasn't even done that.
And you know what, Ethel? You know, the man is in hot water, right?
Oh, yeah.
Don't you think that if he were to step up to the plate, do something for IRP 6 and some other folks who are out there that need somebody to do something for him, I think he could get some good press out of
it.
It so,
might turn
you know,
the fire down a little bit under.
Hey, Mr. Holder or anyone that knows Mr. Holder, if you're out there listening, any congressman, any representatives, whatever, you know, you might just want to drop a bug in Mr. Holder's ear and say, hey, you know, the GOP is getting ready to come after you, man, and so you might want to, you know, find some kind of way to get some good press. Y'all, either of you watch that show Scandal?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love that show. And it's all about putting the right spin on stuff.
You're right.
And, you know, they always got somebody back there behind closed doors trying to say, hey, how can you get me out of
look,
this jam?
Look, wheeling and dealing.
So,
you
Mr. Holder, we're giving you an out here.
Yes, we are.
You know, our number is 855-529-4252, 855-529-4252. And so, you know, you want us to stop calling your number, what's that number, Ethel?
202-514-2003.
And you know,
202-514-2003.
Give it one more time.
202-514-2003. And also 2005.
It's real simple for Attorney General Holder to, you know, to basically make some type of leeway in getting the GOP off his back. It's do something.
Exactly.
Anything. He gets up, he makes this grandiose speech like, oh, yeah, we're incarcerating too many people for no good lawful reason.
Right.
Well, that right there says you need to do something.
Thank
and he
you.
Talks a good talk, but then what did he do? Now he's set back for the last, 3 months? 4 months since
finally
he made that.
Finally did something.
And then when he does something, uh-huh. it's this little tiny gesture like see you guys, I went over there and I swept up the mouse crap
uh-huh.
instead of going out and laying out traps and killing the rodents. It's like, well, I did sweep up the mess they made. Do something.
He's trying to keep from stepping in the cotton-picking mouse trap.
That's right.
And he goes out there and he's giving us crap that we already know. We know it's the 2-point-something million people that's already in prison for no good law enforcement reason.
That's right.
What we want to know is what is he going to do about it?
What are you going to do
about it? And, you know, when we talk about the thing as far as wrongful convictions and misconduct and all that kind of stuff, you know, the Virginia Law School, they have just started a petition out on, and ironically, it's a website called causes.com. When I saw that, it was like, wow, that's so close to our name. But www.causes.com, Virginia Law School started a petition to remove absolute judicial immunity. And I know you're going to love this one, Cliff, to hold the judicial community responsible for their actions. Now, they're seeking 100,000 signatures. And so, you know, you can do your research. Go out there to www.causes.com, that's C-A-U-S-E-S, mm-hmm. with an S, .com, and they've got a petition to remove absolute judicial immunity. Now, basically what that's talking about is some of the things that the IRP 6 has run into. You got Judge Christine Arguello, mm-hmm. who has been doing things under the cover, over the cover, on a sidebar, in the jury room. It's just all over the place.
Is it between the covers, too?
We don't know. And you know, even A Just Cause has a petition out on change.org along this same lines where we're looking to strengthen the laws that hold prosecutors accountable for their judicial misconduct. And so, you know, we need to ensure that citizens' rights are protected from this wrongful conviction kind of stuff. I mean, you know, when we talk about the IRP6, so Cliff, you know, this past week we found out, or a couple of weeks ago, we found out that the writ of mandamus that was filed by the appellate attorney, Gwendolyn Solomon,
mm-hmm.
that it was denied. And so we put out a press release that talks about that. We'll be pulling those press release numbers in a few minutes and let you know how well that's doing as far as, you know, it's getting a lot of exposure.
Awesome. It is.
But, you know, the guys, the IRP 6, right. they have written some comments about it. And, you know, the comments are posted on PRWeb.com. You can go to www.PRWeb.com and do a search on IRP 6, and you can pull up some of their comments that are embedded in the press release. We got Attorney Mark Garagos out of L.A., Attorney Cornell Johnson out of Denver, and then Tina Glandian. She's also part of Garagos & Garagos, who's working on this as well. And so, you know, Cliff, as far as give a little bit of background on the IRP 6 case, and then we'll talk about this writ of mandamus. We'll pull some of the comments that the guys talked about, and then we'll see how that all ties in with the LaWanna Clark case. We'll be going to a break here in a minute or so, but let's give that overview real quick.
Okay, just as a real quick overview, IRP Solutions was raided by the FBI for allegedly scamming staffing companies, but what really happened is that the company was responding to requests from the government to modify its Silk software, that's its flagship software, Case Investigative Lifecycle, commonly known as Silk, and they got behind on paying invoices because in order to modify their software, IRP had to use temporary staffing companies that specialized in technology professionals. Now, IRP brought these temps on board to work on the software, but when IRP didn't close business as quickly as it thought it would, that's when invoices went delinquent and allegations of wrongdoing came up. So the IRP 6 case, this is a case of corporate debt collection that got criminalized by an overzealous FBI agent named John Smith and an over-empowered assistant U.S. attorney named Matthew Kirsch. Now, when the FBI special agent Smith, he orchestrated a raid on IRP, he got a search warrant stating that in so many words that IRP was a front company. And then assistant U.S. attorney Matthew Kirsch then prosecuted the case, although there was evidence and expert witnesses that would substantiate the legitimacy of IRP Solutions as a business. Then the federal judge, Christine Arguello, we want to make sure we get her name out there.
Please.
She presided over the case, and she didn't give the IRP 6 any reasonable consideration or benefit of the doubt during their trial, In fact, the transcripts are missing, over 200 pages of transcripts that would show that critical rights were violated that happened during the trial of the IRPC.
And, Cliff, we'll come back to that right after this break. You're tuned to A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We'll be right back in a couple of minutes.
Good morning, students, and welcome to Career Day. I hope you're excited to hear about all the great things you can do when you grow up.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emily. I'm super excited to introduce my dad because he's my hero. When I was little, my dad was away a lot. But I was okay with that because he was doing this really important work, driving ambulances in Iraq. Now he's at home, which is great for me because I get to see him every day now. And he's still the biggest hero I know because he tells all the ambulances and the firemen where to go and rescue people when they're in the emergency. I'm so proud of him. He's awesome. He's my dad.
If your service-connected disability prevents you from continuing in your civilian career, Voc Rehab offers counseling, training with a living allowance, education, and other services to help prepare you for your next mission.
When does it stop being partly cloudy and start being partly sunny? Why is the word abbreviation so long? Are English muffins just muffins in England? Why is it called a washing line and not a drying line? Do fish get thirsty? If ghosts can walk through doors, why don't they fall through floors? Do you yawn when you sleep? If prunes are dried plums, how do they make prune juice? Why do doctors leave the room when you change? They're going to see you naked anyway. Do bald chefs wear hairnets? How much deeper would the ocean be if all the sponges were taken out? Do you believe someone who says they're a chronic liar? Why is sandwich bread square and sandwich meat round? Life's full of hard questions. Ask one more. You might just save a life.
Respecting an establishment.
Religion.
Or prohibiting the free exercise
thereof.
Or abridging the freedom of speech.
Or of the press.
Or the right
of the people, peaceably,
to assemble
and to petition
the government
for a redress of grievances.
Thanks for staying with us. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, your host, being joined by Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. In the studio also, we'll be joining us shortly, is LaWanna Clark, and we'll be talking about her case and how it ties in with the IRP6. We will also have Judith Housley, a board-certified forensic document examiner, will be joining us, tongue-tied, a little bit later to talk about LaWanna's case as well. Callers, you can call in at 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. Now, Cliff, we were talking about the IRP6 and basically how they were developing software for law enforcement, federal, state, and local. The software was called SILC, for Case Investigative Lifecycle. Had some great opportunities with the Department of Homeland Security, NYPD, And in order to answer some of the requests of the Department of Homeland Security, and this was occurring back in 2003, they engaged the services of staffing companies, as you were saying. And Susan Holland from ETI, she basically made some threats and said that, you know, either you pay up because the business didn't turn as quickly as anticipated. And so she basically said, either you pay up or I'm going to destroy your life and I'm going to destroy the lives of people around you. And so that's when things just, you know, kind of started getting a little weird. And talk about that little web of folks that are involved and how that all came about. And then we'll start talking about LaWanna's case. And I definitely want to read a little bit from the IRP6 as far as how they feel about the writ of mandamus being denied.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Susan Holland of ETI Professionals, and she's got these connections and relationships at Holland & Hart Law Firm up in Denver, Colorado. And one of the partners there named Greg Goldberg, he was previously an assistant U.S. attorney up in the Denver attorney's office. And so you have him, he gets contacted by Susan Holland. She tells him, you know, basically she needs a favor called in. He compiles this, you know, a package of all these reasons and all this conjecture, saying, you know, in this package, he tells Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirst, go after these guys for wire fraud, for mail fraud, for money laundering, for racketeering, all this insane reasons to say go after an indictment. Mm-hmm. He hand carries that over to Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirst, which he used to work with. And, you know, the issue with that is that it is against the law for a private attorney to basically inject or interfere in a federal case. But this Goldberg, he takes this stuff over to Matthew Kirst, and then it was found later on that you know, during the investigation, he was going back and forth, you know, faxes were going between him and the FBI agent that was investigating the case, FBI agent John Smith. And, I mean, you have evidence being sent from the FBI to this private attorney. That is
basically
against the law.
Trying to set up the IRP-6.
Right, trying to set up the IRP-6. And it's like, how do you say that you're in private practice, you used to be an assistant U.S. attorney, and here's an FBI agent sending you evidence on a case that it's supposed to be investigating.
And as we were talking about this the other day, you know, one of the things that I mentioned was that stood out to me is Holland & Hart, they are a law firm that actually defends corporations. Mm-hmm. They defend executives of companies that find themselves being subjected to investigations by whatever federal agency that might come after them.
Right.
And so here you have a man who's day-to-day, his day job, let me put it that way,
right.
His day job mm-hmm. is to defend people
right.
that are accused of the same types of things mm-hmm. that IRP are accused of, but in yes. the shadows of the night.
Mm-hmm. His alter ego.
Exactly. Okay. He started framing up stuff to help indict and investigate
yeah.
and convict the IRP-6.
Yeah, and he's, I mean, you have where... It would be one thing if you say, well, this person at this firm, they had an issue and their client came up with this issue, and so they passed it over to the U.S. Attorney's office. Then the U.S. Attorney will say, hey, look, this is not in my court yet.
Right, right.
You need to contact the FBI and let them know that you think something is going on. Well,
which somebody did.
One of the staffing companies did do that. Mm-hmm. What do you think the FBI came back with? They said, hey, this is a civil matter. You need to take this up in civil court. And this was after the raid, after John Smith, supposedly, who had done his due diligence, who had done his investigation, you know, he lied to a federal judge right. to get his search warrant, saying there is no software, this is a front company, even though he had interviewed people at Department of Homeland Security, who IRP had dealings with. He had interviewed people at New York Police Department that IRP had dealing with. He interviewed subject matter experts that worked at IRP who were retired federal agents.
Right.
I mean, we had a affidavit that was signed and sworn to by a retired federal ICE agent, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. You're talking about a man who had been in the business for over 20 years, had retired. He knows how to do investigations. He knows fraud when he sees it. He knows a front
That's right.
company.
That's it.
He knows all these things being a federal employee at the criminal level mm-hmm. on saying this is how you go after a fraudulent company. He had a signed affidavit that he gave to FBI agent John Smith and said, no, I'm working at IRP as a subject matter expert. They have viable software. Mm-hmm. It's useful for local, federal, and state government.
Right.
I'm working for free right now. Mm-hmm. They will pay me once the software is sold, and I want to stay on board because I realize that when this sells, it will be monetarily beneficial
exactly.
for me.
Yeah.
So you
exactly.
have, and not only him, but two other retired federal agents. And when you say retired, you know, you're looking at people with over 20 years of
right.
experience. But then you have this rookie, wet behind the ears FBI agent, mm-hmm. John Smith. How does he take the words of a man who has over 20 years of experience, use his 18 months that he had at the time of the investigation, and craft this search warrant saying, well, it's a front company?
Because somebody else was pulling the
strings. Exactly. Somebody else told him, Matt Kirsch, Greg Goldberg,
yep.
Susan Holland,
that's
told
right.
him, you find me something on these people that we can go after them.
That's
and
right.
it shows how sickening the system can be when you have rotten apples in the barrel. And then to make it even worse, you have the judge that presided over the case, ironically was the same judge that presided over LaWanna Clark's case, this Judge Christine Arguello, she used to work at Holland & Hart. So you have all these friends.
And that name is going to come up again.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You have all these friends and possibly
yeah.
relatives between Susan Holland and Holland & Hart that have come together to ensure that these six men get prosecuted, and
yes.
the judge is there to ensure that their evidence isn't presented.
Right.
That nothing that happens during their case is anything good, that even their court-appointed attorneys,
right.
which gratefully they got rid of,
mm-hmm.
that even they were trying to get them, no, do a plea deal, go ahead, take your 20 years,
yes.
say you're guilty so you have no chance of appeal, and we can get you out of the way.
The number is 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Ethel.
No, I was just wondering about that because I'm thinking about these retired federal agents who were working in IRP at the time. You know, something must have happened there as well, because did they tell these guys we're going to do something to your pensions if you open your mouth?
Well, no, actually, Gary Hilberry, he was a witness at the IRP trial.
Okay.
And so, you know, aside from, you know, coming just short of perjuring himself,
yeah.
you know, he had to tell the truth
yeah.
as far
yeah.
as he was working there.
Yeah.
And
okay.
but what you look at is you mm-hmm. see, even though he was a witness,
mm-hmm.
his affidavit was presented, but the judge would not allow.
The jury couldn't see
they
it.
They would not allow the jury to see his affidavit. They would not. She would not allow the defendants to read off the affidavit. She said, you can let Gary Hilberry read his own affidavit to refresh his memory so that you don't impeach
him. And that's reading it to himself.
That's right.
Reading it
not
to
reading
himself,
it out loud.
Not out loud.
That is amazing.
And when they ask, can we put this on the screen so that the jury can see it,
mm-hmm.
the judge says straight out, no, you cannot put – this is a sworn affidavit. This is a court record. Why can the jury not see this? And she would not allow it to be put into evidence so that the jury could see it during deliberations. And so you look at this outside or not outside, but combined
yeah.
with all of the other egregious acts that the
yeah.
judge did. And you say, why is she going out of her way
exactly.
to ensure that this evidence isn't presented? And your only answer can be that she conspired with Matthew Kirsch to ensure these men were convicted.
Yeah. And you know, let's go to this break here. And then when we come out of the break, we're going to touch on that writ of mandamus. And then we're going to roll right into LaWanna. We're going to bring Judith Housley in. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Write this number down, 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. You can also follow along with us on some of the things we're talking about. You can go to www.freetheirp6. That's the number 6. .org, freetheirp6.org. We'll be right back after this.
Today, innocent Americans are standing trial for crimes they didn't commit. Today, innocent Americans are writing for help from a prison cell. Today, hundreds of Americans have been exonerated of crimes they didn't commit. Researchers believe that at least 40,000 innocent Americans still sit behind bars. For them, the answers do not come easy. A Just Cause seeks true balance and accountability in the judicial process, ensuring that innocent men and women are not convicted and sentenced to prison for trivial, obscure acts that are otherwise not seen as crimes. For more information on how A Just Cause may help you or how you can get involved to stop over-criminalization of innocent Americans, visit www.a-justcause.com or call 855-529-4252. That's 855-529-4252.
Federal government targeted, prosecuted, convicted, six executives in, held back evidence. Come on, hundreds of pages of Mr. Manuscript, court circuit, 10th district denying the writ of mandamus. Free the RP6, critical rights violations, scandalous, their motivation to finish their business with major companies, the government, New York PD, DHS, potential customers. Come on, faith potential, obtain funding from banks and angel investors with no success. That com mail down, finance skeptics, so they hire staff and come to fill the gap with every attention to fulfill the contract, to the deal when money come back. Everybody paid the bills, the wages, take care of all of that. No Friday, they got viable software, but you prepare them to those with nothing to offer. Prosecuted by the attorney's office before the FBI got to start investigating charges, skipping steps in the process, even barring the testimony of Andrew Averell, a witness who could tell why any staffing company that could do with them Rash Street credit check would stick out their neck. If there was no prospect they could collect when they're reeling the net, it all relates to Harvey Silver Glade statements about the vagueness of federal law, judicial chaos, A_JustCause. Read at RP6.org, 347-205-9620, Just Blog. It's just us, but we don't gotta just talk. We can just march through the courts for the cause with one voice. It's just free them all. Come on.
You're tuned to A Just Cause Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman. In the background, you just heard a song, Free the IRP6, written by Dallas Burgess out of Jacksonville, North Carolina. I want to say thank you, Dallas, for doing that song. And I guess Darcy Della Prosa, our friend over across the ocean there in Europe, she hooked us up with Dallas. And Dallas, I guess, listens to the program almost every week. And so, you know, Dallas, the IRP6, as well as the Just Cause and all the folks here, we really appreciate the effort that you put into doing that. And so you'll hear that song played from time to time. So, and that little hook at the end, no peace until we free the IRP6. You know, that's a good song, you know, and it kind of gets you bouncing in the chair just a little bit, you know. Hey, so back to, let me see here. Let me get this phone number out again. 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. 9620. That's our call-in number for callers. If you'd like to call in and have a question or a comment about anything that we're talking about, you can also go to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org. Okay, so Cliff, there was one part in the IRP6 case that is directly tied to what we were saying as far as the writ of mandamus and so forth, where the judge violated their Fifth Amendment right.
Right, right. What happened is, you know, the prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, he claimed that it was going to take him about 3 weeks to present his case in chief. And he basically rested his case in about a week and a half. So that left the defense to say, hey, we need to start presenting our witnesses. Well, their witnesses were coming from, you know, places like D.C., New York, you know, the Eastern Seaboard. When you're dealing with a Department of Homeland Security, New York Police Department, Philly PD, places like that. You know, these people, to be witnesses, have to set up, you know, their time off work. They have to set up travel arrangement. They have to set up their hotel accommodations, all these things for them to get to Denver, Colorado. Well, when it came down to time for the defense to present their witnesses, you know, the IRP6 had to pretty much scramble to kind of readjust the schedule. So they tried to get the people who were local, who they could talk to, because they did have local law enforcement that they were dealing with, like at Colorado Bureau of Investigations and places like that. And at CBI, they had, you know, one witness. His name was Colin Reese. They had been dealing with him. And Mr. Reese was called as a witness, had been subpoenaed. And when it was time for him to show up, he just, you know, basically said, well, you know, I'm at work. I'll see if I can get there. And everybody knows, you know, when you get subpoenaed to go to court, you have to basically show up. If you don't show up, you're basically in contempt of court. The judge can basically say, hey, either you show up right here, right now, or I will have a federal marshal come to your house, come to your work, arrest you, and drag you basically into the courtroom. Well, instead of Judge Arguello doing that, she tells IRP6, you know, when they bring to her attention that we talked to Mr. Reese and we cannot get a response from him, you know, instead she says it's your responsibility to get your witness here. That is not the way that it happens in court. If there is an issue with a witness that has been subpoenaed, that has been properly subpoenaed to show up in court, and that witness does not show up, it is the judge's responsibility to basically come and get that person into court to testify. Well, after that happened, you know, there was an FBI agent Mullen. He was supposed to testify. When it was time for him to be served, he was at work. He wouldn't come out to receive the papers. And, you know, from the process server, when they went to his house to try to serve him, another FBI agent shows up. Mm-hmm. This FBI agent tells the process server, you're not going to serve, you know, this Agent Moen. You're going to go talk to the prosecutor about it. Mm-hmm. And when this is a really sickening part, because when this comes up during the trial, the prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, stands up and says, yeah, Your Honor, you know, I talked to this FBI agent, Moen. He's out. He's on a hunting trip. He's not going to be available. I mean, not only did he dodge the process server so he wouldn't have to be subpoenaed, but then he's in touch with the prosecutor, Matthew Kirsch. Now, if you or I, if we're in touch with the other side's witness, we get in trouble.
Right.
That is called witness tampering. Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes down to it, the judge tells the IRP6, once they dealt with all those witnesses that could show up, if you don't have another witness to put on the stand, if you don't have somebody to present, I will rest your case, or either one of you will get on the stand, you will testify, or I will rest your case. So what is the defendant to do if the judge says, I'm going to rest your case?
And she wasn't polite about it.
Right, she's not polite about it. She's angry about the fact that their witnesses aren't there. Well, Matthew Kirsch is the one who ended his case almost 2 weeks before he was supposed to, and then the judge reprimands the IRP6, and it's like, where is the help from the judge?
But
where
she doesn't reprimand the prosecutor.
Right,
for,
she doesn't
for,
reprimand
exactly.
him for,
exactly.
for being in touch with their witness.
And then, you know, when you think about it, then she makes them get on the stand.
Yeah.
And then they ask for, at the end of the day, they say, okay, we want that transcript, because they realize that, okay, that our Fifth Amendment has been violated.
Exactly.
As a matter of fact, they stated that during the trial.
Right.
Those pages are not produced.
Right.
She does not ensure that those pages are produced. And so then you have the court appointed
the court reporter
Darlene Martinez.
Right.
Even when the judge says, now this is the part that really got us as Just Cause began to dig into the transcript, look into this whole situation with these parts of the transcript being missing. You have a conversation between the judge and the court reporter, Darlene Martinez, where the judge is saying, okay, you know, because my brother, Clint Stewart, he asked, Your Honor, before we bring the jury back in, we need to deal with this fact that we want the transcript where you told us, one of us, that we had to take the stand. Mm-hmm. Well, she talks to Darlene Martinez, well, how much of this transcript is missing? She says, it's over 200 pages. The judge makes these statements. Okay, well, over 200 pages. Well, you know, I'm not gonna tell her that she needs to rush and get those to you. I don't see any reason why you need them. How do you tell a defendant you don't see any reason that they need the transcript from their trial? Without your entire full transcript, you cannot put on a proper appearance.
That's right. Wait a minute. You're talking about over 200 pages.
Over 200
pages. So who knows how many pages is really missing?
Exactly. Right? And it's not going to be those 200 pages or 200 pages plus are going to include more than just what occurred on that sidebar.
Right.
So
right.
Now comes a just cause, and we file a lawsuit.
Right. And we say, we want to see, because when we go to the court and this, you know, after trial, the entire transcript is supposed to be available about 2 weeks after trial, everything that the court reporter took down. Well, we don't find it in the court's records. We don't find it when we go to the courthouse and say, hey, we want to see everything that pertains
That's
to this
right.
case. So we say, well, Darlene Martinez, since you were the court reporter, we want the entire transcript. She says, well, you'll have to pay for it. We say, okay. As a just cause, we will pay for that transcript, and we did. She did not deliver the entire thing. So we're like, where is the rest of this transcript? Well, it's not available. And we get this plethora of excuses of why the transcript isn't available, and the court reporter's access, the entire transcript, everything has to be available for at least 10 years after the trial is over. And so we sue her and say, hey, she's in breach of contract as a independent contractor. We hired her to deliver the transcript, you know, basically transcribe to English, not the shorthand and all that.
Right.
But we want the entire thing. She did not do that. So we reached out to all these different places and said, who do we go to basically say, make her give us the transcript
right,
we paid
right.
for? So we go to the U.S. Attorney's office up in Denver with John Walsh. His office says, well, why don't you sue her? She's in breach of contract. Mm-hmm. She didn't give you what you paid for. Sue her. We don't have any jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So we sued her. When we did sue her, who comes to her rescue but the U.S. Attorney's office?
Yep,
says,
yep.
We're going to represent her. She was acting as a federal employee. You know, we're going to bring her under our umbrella of protection. Well, you just told us a few weeks ago that she was not under your jurisdiction, and now suddenly you're representing her. When does the federal government represent any member of the general public and says, we'll be your attorney? Taxpayers' dollar is being the attorney for this Darlene Martinez when she was not acting as a federal employee.
And, you know, I think it's all part of the, like we were saying at the top of the program, you know, there are petitions out there all over the place as far as trying to bring about some accountability. When you talk about
right.
judicial misconduct,
right.
you talk about prosecutorial misconduct,
right.
and that was a ploy, Cliff, I think, to protect where the Judge Arguello was going to be implicated in this thing.
Absolutely.
And they are playing it to the hilt. And going parallel with that, appellate attorney Gwendolyn Solomon, she filed a writ of mandamus. And basically what that is again, is like, well, we recognize that there was a problem here. There was something that was not requested previously.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the writ of mandamus was specifically to address the fact that
right.
we want the court to compel
yes.
the judge and the court reporter to release those 200 pages. And
right.
then they came back and denied that.
And denied it with the fact saying this is
a frivolous
claim. It's like, how is it frivolous when these men have been sitting in federal prison for 15 months? How is it frivolous when I'm sitting in prison and my only way of getting a proper appeal is to have my entire transcript, with this being a critical issue on appeal that my Fifth Amendment right was violated, and you tell me that's frivolous
but
for me
know,
to make that request?
These men sitting in prison with families here,
yep.
and you going to tell me some crap about this is frivolous?
That's right. And, you know, Gary Walker, he wrote a comment on this, and he basically said that, you know, the disappearance of this transcript is of the most controversial portion of the trial transcript, and its entire unedited transcript can occur only without prompt remedial action being taken by the courts, is an indictment of this country's criminal justice system. Basically, he's saying, you know, the things that y'all are pulling off in this situation, you're just as criminal because you are covering up evidence that would exonerate us. These men have been sitting in prison now, as far as this part of the conviction, for over 14 months, 15 months, basically. They spent time even before that So it's been, you know, over 2 years
now
since that trial has occurred. And, you know, and there are a lot of things that are just going on as far as the appeal is concerned. You got that. You got the speedy trial motion that's been violated. You got what else is part of
that? Then we have the fact that expert witness expulsory evidence,
forensic evidence.
It is so many things that point to the fact that this trial, at the very least, needs to be retried. And at what really needs to happen is this whole thing needs to be thrown out. There have been many issues, so many acts and what they call errors, but it doesn't seem like
deliberate.
An error when
it was deliberate.
You deliberately do these things. So many things that happen that this trial, this whole case needs to be thrown out.
And even before it went to trial, you know, there were some things that happened with some other folks as far as in the family, as far as David's sister, LaWanna Clark. And we're going to come back after this break. We're going to have LaWanna Clark here in the studio. We have Judith Housley on the phones, and we're going to talk about how LaWanna ties into this case. Right here on the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We'll be right back.
I wanted to be in the military since I was a kid.
I served in the United States Air Force.
I served a total of 16 years.
I was deployed 13 times.
On my second deployment, 4 bombs hit my vehicle.
And at 19 years old, that's the first time I ever saw somebody die.
Coming back, I was raging.
I started having pretty horrible nightmares.
I would wake up in the middle of the night, sweats.
I started drinking a lot.
I felt worthless.
I guess I never recognized it in myself.
Eventually, one day, I just walked into the VA hospital and said I'd like to see somebody.
Don't suffer alone. You got to find that link with somebody that'll make you let it go.
It all starts with going to the VA. There's a whole community of veterans that just want to help you out.
It's for the guys who couldn't come back, so you owe it to them to live well, because they're not here with their families.
Sergeant Michelle Garcia served meritoriously in Iraq and has the medals to prove it. Soon after leaving the Navy, Lieutenant Chris Scott found a job, a home, and started a family of his own. Corpsman Richard Stokely took the skills he learned in Vietnam and put them to good use as a paramedic. But soon after leaving the military, each of these veterans fell on hard times and faced homelessness. Even after Michelle lost all her savings, even after Chris wasn't able to pay his mortgage, and even after Richard battled alcoholism for years, they each reached out for help when they needed it most. A simple phone call put them in touch with a trained professional from the Department of Veterans Affairs. That call got Michelle a place to stay until she could afford one of her own, put Chris in touch with employment assistance, and found Richard a substance abuse program. These veterans are success stories not only for how they were able to help others serving their country, but for how they were able to let others help them. If you know or are a veteran in need, make the call.
I can solve difficult problems for a Fortune 500 company.
I can run a successful business.
I can manage your home improvements.
I can publicize your message.
I can motivate your audience.
I can put my military experience to work for your company.
I can teach your children.
I can boost your bottom line.
I can add value to your workplace.
I could be a loyal and productive employee.
But I can't put my skills to work for your organization
if I'm not given the opportunity.
If you don't recognize my talents and ability.
If you don't hire me.
If you don't have an open mind and a workplace that's open to everyone.
If you don't realize that America works best when everybody works.
What can you do?
What can you do?
What can you do?
You can remember that it works.
It's what people can do.
It's what people can do that matters.
Nearly 50 million Americans have disabilities. Capitalize on their talents with employment practices that benefit everyone. Learn more at whatcanyoudocampaign.org.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast, I'm Sam Thurman, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. My co-host Cliff Stewart, Ethel Lopez. Joining us in the studio is LaWanna Clark. Our phone number, folks, is 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. It's about to get good now. You know, just when you thought you heard everything about this case and you wonder, well, who is LaJuana Clark and what does this have to do with the IRP6? Well, LaJuana Clark is the sister of David Banks. And we've talked about in the IRP6 case how, you know, all the points that are on appeal, all the things that have happened. You know, in the case of the IRP6, there were two grand juries. The first grand jury said this is a debt collection case. And then Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch convened a second grand jury. He only called one witness, and that being FBI agent Moen. He got the indictment. You also have the situation where, you know, they tried to say that it was not a viable company, a legitimate company developing viable software, and just a myriad of things. So it was like they were grasping for straws to try and bring a conviction, try and bring down this company, and it all goes back to that web of folks that Cliff was talking about earlier. Welcome to the program, LaJuana. How you doing this evening?
I'm just fine, Sam. How are you?
Doing great. So, again, folks ask, well, how is LaJuana Clark tied to this? And I said, you know, again, that what I was just stating was that they were grasping for straws. So, basically, they brought you in, and I'm going to have you tell your story here in a second, but you recall before a grand jury.
Yes.
And asked about some of the business practices of IRP Solutions, and you were asked over almost 300 questions, if not more. And Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch basically, you know, found three questions where he was able to get an indictment, and it all came down to whether or not you signed a withdrawal slip from a bank.
Yes, yes. The withdrawal slip, which was so didn't even make any sense, was the fact that the account was in my name, which if I had signed the withdrawal slip, I had the right to do it since the account was in my name. I opened the company open the account under my name so that they could use it for business, for a different business. And so my sister and her husband at that time, but he was not employed, and so I was one of the ones that could help to open the account up. So I said, feel free to do so, and whatever monies go in there, that's, you know, whatever you need to do to sign, to retract money or to put money in or whatever, whatever you had to do, do it. I never even checked on it. It wasn't my – because I let them use my name. The money was not my money.
And it's not like something was being done behind your back or anything. I mean, you were well aware of everything that was going on as far as – you know, or you had authorized your sister, Yolanda Walker, to execute the transactions and so forth. Mm-hmm. So let's get to this point as far as what Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, he got hung up on this thing about this withdrawal slip. Mm-hmm. And so saying that you signed the withdrawal slip, and like you said, so what? It's my account.
Mm-hmm.
But you stated that you didn't sign it.
No.
Your sister, Yolanda, signed it.
Yes, she did.
And you stated that before the grand jury.
Yes, I did.
And Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, he gets the grand jury to believe that you lied.
Yes, he called me a liar many times right in front of the jury, and he was the liar. I wasn't the liar. And what I said was true. I didn't sign it. My sister did. And he just kept persisting that this is my signature, this is her signature, this is LaJuana Clark's, and yet he had no proof of that at all. And when we looked at it, we realized, me and my sister personally, we were sitting there and said, that is her signature. It was blatantly plain.
And, you know, when we go back and look at some of the conversations that occurred, your appellate attorney, John Klein, now your original attorney, let's talk about that, name is Kornfeld. What's his full name?
Rick
Kornfeld?
Yes.
And so Kornfeld, he was originally, he was an attorney that you were paying, correct?
Yes, yes.
And he did not, there were certain things that he did not do. And then basically he did not allow your sister to testify.
No, he didn't.
And then as far as character witnesses, and we're talking, you know, after the indictment and this trial has started, and he did not allow people to speak on your character.
No, he didn't.
Now, let's talk about that. Now, LaJuana, you have been raised in a family that, you know, you're active in your church, active in your community. You are a giving person and never had any kind of run-ins with the law, especially at this level.
No, I didn't. I might have had a speeding ticket a couple of times in my life, but that was about it. That's why it was such a shocking and very difficult time for me, for my family, for our church, for everybody, because there was no reason for me to be pulled into something like this.
Except they were trying to...
they were trying to get the IRP-6 to bow to them. That's what they were trying to do.
And basically it looks like, and I think John Klein, he actually said that a perjury trap was set for you.
Yes, yes.
And so going along with what you were talking about as far as Kirsch trying to basically force the IRP-6 to do something, and so they see, okay, let's say like your brother, David Banks.
Yes.
So he sees his sister being subjected to all of this.
Yes.
So then, you know, let's just go with this theory that, you know, Kirsch is going to say, well, you know, he sees his sister going through this, so he's going to step up and say, yeah, we're guilty.
Yeah, we can't allow, there's no way we can let, I can't let my sister go through this. But I would have never allowed them not to let me go through it.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to let these crooks make these men bow after all that they did and all the work they put in and the time and the effort and all that they gave to try to help this country. I wouldn't, there was no way I would allow it.
And you know, the thing is also when you look at how one of the attorneys for one of the IRP-6s is at the time that they still had court-appointed attorneys, because you know, mm-hmm. if folks have been following the story, they know that the IRP-6 represented themselves pro se.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to them firing their attorneys, mm-hmm. one of their attorneys even said to Kendrick Barnes, I believe it was, mm-hmm. he said, well, it doesn't matter if mm-hmm. there's evidence to clear LaWanna. She's going to do some jail time. When you hear something like that, it makes
me.
I was telling somebody today, some of the thoughts and stuff that goes on in my head, I couldn't say it on the air, and I couldn't say, you know, what I would, you know, as far as recourse.
Yes.
Let's just say that some of these people that have pulled some of this stuff off, they need to be subjected to the same things
that they
dished out.
You know what, though, with that no good attorney that she had, I would tell people out there, if you hear a Rick Kornfeld coming, you need to run like a jackass.
That's right.
You sure do.
I mean, you know, again, he did not allow your sister to get on the stand.
No.
And she was willing to testify that, no, that's my signature.
And he had said from the beginning that she would definitely be on the stand.
And the thing is, you know, the truth is going to come out as far as, and the truth is going to prevail. It's like, okay, yeah, I get on the stand. I say it's my signature. I'm telling the truth. But my sister, LaWanna gave me authorization to make a withdrawal from this business account.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, it's
not. I mean, people do power attorneys to take care of stuff all the time.
Yes.
And then you have people that were not allowed to testify who would testify as to your character. And it's my understanding that Kirsch even objected to that and would not allow them to even get into conversation about that.
That's right.
And under this stupid premise that, well, your character is not on trial.
And also, after, you know, speaking with some of the people who were there in the gallery during the trial, we found out that after the character witnesses had actually been on the stand and, you know, he made his objections and they were able to make these short statements about who LaWanna was, that even after that, when they would leave the room, he would tell the jury, yeah, she had these people come in here and lie about who she is. How do you say that a character witness is lying? You're telling me that people that are getting on the stand, they're swearing to tell the truth in front of a court, and then you blatantly call a character witness a lie. Those are the type of things when you look at that and you say you were just trying to get her to go to prison.
That's
no
right.
evidence.
That's
and
right.
even when the evidence
right.
came that you knew she was innocent, you still persisted in
uh-huh.
ensuring that she went to prison. It's totally ridiculous.
And you know the thing on the handwriting thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know when that was presented.
Yes.
And is Judith on the phone? Is she there yet?
Yes.
Yes, she is holding on the line.
Let's bring Judith into this conversation.
Okay, let's bring her in.
Yeah, we're going to have Judith Housley join in on the conversation. Judith is a board-certified forensic document examiner. And, you know, LaWanna, you and your family have petitioned Rick Kornfeld
yes.
to do a handwriting analysis to be able to present to the court
that's right. that's
that
right.
not only am I saying that this is not my signature, not only is my sister saying that it is her signature,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Kornfeld, you know, let's do an analysis on this. He refused to do an analysis.
Yes,
he was playing. He was a part in this thing to try and get you set up and get you convicted.
Yeah, it was his job to say, let's do a handwriting.
Exactly. It wasn't. Yes. It shouldn't have been your responsibility to do that.
That's right.
Then your family say, okay, let's find a forensic handwriting expert. Let's find a handwriting expert. So you guys find Judith Housley. Judith, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fine.
Thanks for joining us on the Just Cause Coast to Coast as we talk about Luana's case. And I know that you have done a little bit of research on some of the other components of this case. So we're talking about how, you know, the family, her family had to reach out and find someone to do a handwriting analysis to prove that she did not sign this withdrawal slip. So they come to you, Judith. And so what kind of information was presented to you, and then what actually goes into doing a forensic analysis of a document?
They sent me known handwriting of Luana and Yolanda, and they sent me the documents in question, including the withdrawal slip. And what happens is when I get those, I establish a handwriting pattern for both writers, and then I compare that handwriting pattern to the question writing to see if it's the same writer or it's somebody else. And my opinion was Luana didn't sign it, but Yolanda did. I submitted the letter of opinion to Rick Cornfield. I never heard another word.
Wow. I mean that just reeks right there. And you are a board-certified document examiner. You have how many years of experience, Judith?
Well over 35.
And what kind of expertise? I mean, we need to set this for the audience so that they understand, you know, that we're not just talking about someone who just kind of took a quick look at it and said, well, you know, it's either this or that. What kind of experience do you have? What kind of cases have you worked?
I've worked probably just about every case available, although sometimes I get one that I've never worked before. But wills and contracts and forged deeds and car titles and quit claim deeds, anything where the handwriting is questioned. But as far as training, you train with top board-certified forensic document examiners that are court-qualified. They have testified in court before. They know what they're doing. And then you attend seminars regularly for update and training, like rubber stamps and ink and all kinds of things. But in order to be board certified, you have to take a test. And the test is five parts. And it's pass, fail, period. There's no in between. And I took that test. And the board of directors of the National Association of Document Examiners critique my findings and determine if I am qualified. And I am. And I recertified again in 2007. It requires recertification every 5 years. I also belong to the Scientific Association of Forensic Examiners. I belong to NAID, which is the National Association of Document Examiners, since 1977.
Wow.
And then I went over to the American Forensic Document Examiners, American Society of Forensic Examiners. And it's another organization, but these are people that are all qualified, are busy, testified in court, continuing their education, and they testify all over the country. It's not something that you pick up a book and say, okay, now I'm an expert. It's far more detailed than that. I began training in October of 1967, and I still attend seminars and workshops, and these workshops are taught by professionals, sometimes the FBI, sometimes members, people that are excel in certain areas like ink, and that's called thin layer chromatography, because document examination spreads a wide range of different types of documents and how to examine them and how to do it and do it right.
So, Judith, needless to say, and I'm reading a little bit of your profile here, and it says that you're court appointed in New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado. You've been appointed by the Denver District Court Criminal Division. So needless to say, you're going to have a lot more experience at this than, let's say, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, who might stand up before a jury and hold up a withdrawal slip and say emphatically that this is Luana Clark's signature. And then, you know, basically Kirsch is calling all of Luana's witnesses liars when he just perjured himself. But again, that's another conversation. That's another show where they're protected and they're immune from that type of thing. But when you have, and in this case, you know, a lot of times we talk about prosecutorial misconduct, we talk about judicial misconduct. Here you have a defense attorney, and you provided Rick Kornfeld in November of 2009 with evidence that proved without a shadow of a doubt that LaWanna Clark was innocent. You then followed that up with a FedEx package to Rick Kornfeld again in January of 2010, again reiterating the fact that the signature that was on the withdrawal slip was that of Yolanda Walker, not that of LaWanna Clark, and that LaWanna Clark did not perjure herself. Only to have Kornfeld not present that to the court, did not present it to the original presiding judge, did not present it to the appellate court, and LaWanna goes to prison and reports to prison on March 1st of 2010, and is sentenced to 6 months in federal prison after a judge says, good luck to you, Ms. Clark. I mean, you know, when you hear something like that, I mean, just those words and just some of the things that Judge Arguello said and the way she conducted herself, I mean, we just got to find some kind of way to have folks like that removed off the bench. But like I said, Judith, you know, we talk about prosecutors and judges. Have you ever seen a situation where you have a defense attorney? It's his job to defend his client, and you provided him with the tools to do that, and he did not. I mean, that's like a slap in the face, Judith.
I have never heard of this before. Like I said, I've been in practice well over 35 years and probably closer to 40. But each state has their own guidelines for qualifying a person as an expert witness, and it doesn't have to be just handwriting. It can be engineering or medical or whatever. But there are guidelines for every state. And if you don't meet those guidelines, the court is not going to allow you to testify. And the fact that I've testified all over the country, but primarily the three states that you mentioned, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado, I've also testified in Texas, California, Utah, Florida, New York City. But if you don't meet those guidelines, you're not going to be qualified. The judge will not accept you as an expert witness. He will accept you as a layperson, possibly, but not an expert. So if you don't meet those guidelines, you're not going to be qualified enough to testify. And those guidelines are very stringent. So you have to be able to answer those questions honestly and with enough knowledge to back up the fact that you have the training and you are an expert. I don't understand why this defense attorney did not present it. That's his job, to defend his client.
It sounds to me
like he failed to do that on all rounds.
Not only failed, when you think about it and you look at it and you read the transcript and you follow the case, you realize that not only did he not defend LaWanna, he basically handed her over to the prosecutor. I mean, he did nothing. Not only did he not present this evidence that with all of your credentials that you presented to him and that you absolutely know that he received, he didn't allow the person. I mean, Yolanda Walker said, I will get on the stand and tell the jury that I sign these papers where I sign LaWanna Clark's name. I'm her sister. She gave me permission to. I have that full right on her account. I signed it. And he would not even present her. And it's like, how does a defense attorney turn their back on their client and watch and hand them over to the prosecutor? This is you should be taken outside and flogged in public. That's my opinion of the matter.
This is a just
cause.
Go ahead, Judith. Go ahead.
What you know, the United States of America, you're innocent until proven guilty. But if Mr. Kornfeld, say, took the defense that he didn't use me because I'm not qualified, he's got a problem. I included all of my qualifications in my FedEx back to him, including testimony, where I've testified, the name of the case, the outcome. All of that was presented to him, including all the fact that I'm board certified in my training and what training that involves. And so if that's what he's going to possibly defend himself, he didn't think I was qualified. That's wrong. All he has to do is also go on the Internet. He can contact the National Association.
That you had testified for the government in Colorado in the 10th Circuit. They used you themselves, so he could not say you weren't qualified.
This is a just cause, coast to coast. Judith, stay right there. We're going to talk a little bit more about this. I want you to take us through a scenario and make it plain for us. The number is 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. We have Judith Housley, board-certified forensic document examiner. We're talking about the LaWanna Clark case. LaWanna is here with us here in the studio. We'll be right back after this. A Just Cause Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman, joined by Cliff Stewart, Ethel Lopez. In the studio, we have Luana Clark on the phones. We have Judith Housley, board-certified forensic document examiner. We're talking about the Luana Clark case. The song that you heard during the break is Ultimate Sacrifice. You know, we have Veterans Day coming up on Monday, and so that is in honor of our veterans, of which, you know, some of the IRP6 are and some of the folks in this room are, and so, you know, we salute you. Now, back to this case, Luana Clark, Judith, welcome to the programs and to the program and for staying there with us.
Before
the break, Judith, I said that or asked if you would take us through a scenario. So let's say you send the letter to Rick Kornfell basically stating that Luana Clark is not a liar and that she is telling the truth. And it's proven out by scientific evidence that you would use as a forensic document examiner. You follow that up with another letter that was FedEx to Mr. Kornfell reiterating that fact. What would your expectation be, especially in dealing with a defense attorney? And I think you've told us in one of our previous conversations that, you know, you would expect to be called before the court, go before the jury. You know, explain that scenario for us so our listeners can kind of visualize what should have happened in this case and instead of a young lady being sent to prison. So, Judith, how would that normally go?
Well, you have to understand that in a criminal case or any case, the parties have the right to settle that case. So it was my assumption, since I never got a call, that the case was settled. And when I got the call that it was not settled a few days ago, I was stunned that my report was not used because it's backed up by scientific evidence, and that should have been used. And as I said earlier, I have the qualifications. Why didn't he use me? Well, now I can understand why he didn't. He never intended to use me.
Exactly.
It's my understanding that he did not defend his client.
Oh, he did not defend his client, not at all. And so, Judith, you know, in similar case, well, there's not a case that you're probably going to say is similar to this, but in cases, let's say, that did not settle and you ended up having to go to court, what would you normally do as far as, especially when you have evidence that shows, and again, you know, we have to explain to the listeners that you didn't know Ms. Clark, you didn't know anyone associated with this case, and you don't know the people that you're doing an analysis on. So you're totally impartial, you're approaching it from a scientific perspective, and you're reporting on your findings.
That's all I'm doing, because I testify for the prosecution and the defense, and if I don't hear from the attorney, it's either settled or it's delayed. Sometimes cases go on for years. And I was not aware that this what happened in this case. But you also have to understand that when you're testifying in court, when you're first introduced as a witness, it's up to the court to determine if you're qualified. And they do that through direct examination. And those questions are asked. And if the judge determines that you are qualified, then you proceed. And if you're not, you're not going to testify. But in this case, I didn't testify, and I did not even give it a second thought. And as far as meeting people, most of the time, unless there is a trial or a deposition, I never meet the client that I'm working with. The documents are sent to me. I make an evaluation. I send them back to the client or the attorney, and then I wait for their reply.
So basically,
I've never met Luana.
And so basically what you're saying is that even before you get a chance to testify as an expert witness and share the scientific evidence, you're put on the stand yourself and questioned as to your qualifications. And it's my understanding that you have never been disqualified.
Never.
Never. And how many cases have you been involved in? Well, at least 1,000 or something like that?
Oh, how many cases have I done in 38 years? Thousands and thousands. I've never counted it. But over the course of 35 years, I've testified in probably at least 1,000. But you have to understand that a lot of cases, only 5% of cases actually go to trial as far as the document examiner is concerned. And when you get into court, you're called as a witness. The attorney that has retained you starts direct examination, what that attorney is doing is presenting your qualifications to the court. The court will then decide if he's going to allow you, he or she is going to allow you to testify. I've always testified. I've never been disqualified for any reason.
And you know
because
what?
I have the training and the background to back it up.
And it I might be crazy, Cliff and Ethel and Luana. I might just be a little crazy, but I would go out on a limb on this one. I'd say that even if Kornfeld tried to save face and say, yeah, we're going to bring Judith Housley in and testify on behalf of Luana, why do I get this feeling that she would have been disqualified by Judge Arguello?
Judge Arguello.
I mean, y'all can say I'm crazy or something.
She'd have been kicked off the stand like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, Judith, and that's just how this case has gone. And, yeah. And you know, when you look at the fact that, I mean, they could have at least pretended.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have tried. They could have brought you in, and then they could have done it, what they did so many times that it was almost as if you can predict what their next move was going to be. And it was like, yeah, we got Judith Housley on the stand, and she's a certified board forensic document examiner, and they would have found some kind of way to get you out, except for the fact, you know, Judith, your credentials are so strong and your experience is just so strong that they probably didn't even want to take that chance.
There was no way they
Because, Judith, I mean, you have evidence of your qualifications. That's indisputable. Cliff, what do you have there?
Well, what I wanted to say, and I know that we have a caller on the line, and we appreciate you holding, and we'll get to you in just a moment, but once this evidence was actually presented, you know, after the sentencing and all of that, because Kornfeld didn't bring it up when he first got it. But Judge Arguello, when this was brought up, she basically was saying, well, even though, you know, that evidence is there and it may have proven that, you know, Luana wasn't lying, there's still other evidence that, you know, that would have showed the defendant's guilt. And when you look at that, the only other evidence, the only other way that they could have said that Luana was guilty after you, with your credentials and your experience and how you had even worked for the federal government, was to say that basically the jury could have looked at these documents and come to their own conclusions. I just had a question for you, Judith. I know the answer to this question, but has a jury ever come back and been able to refute your findings and say that the jury's opinion – of what
it's,
the handwriting
stronger
was,
than an expert.
Right, is stronger than what your expert scientific microscopic research had found. How does this judge say this? How does this judge say, oh, no, the jury still could have found her guilty? How? Because the way that they examined the signature by looking at it is more in-depth than what you did. And I mean, it's a rhetorical question, but just so that we have your answer, has a jury ever been able to come back and refute and basically have the defense or the prosecutor or the judge change their mind on what the evidence is because the jury refuted what
just
you
because
found?
Just because the jury said so.
Right.
Well, in my experience, I don't recall a case where that ever happened. But I suspect that Kornfeld, one of the reasons he did not call me is because he knew I was qualified.
That's right.
Right.
For the judge to not allow me to testify would have been a huge judicial error because I have the qualifications. So I think in his mind, and I'm only guessing because I don't know, to present me to the court, I would have defended Luana. And he didn't do that. So the question is, why not?
And someone that could defend me was not going to be allowed.
Right. Exactly.
So.
And, you know, with Kornfeld being part of the prosecutorial team, I mean, you know, that was his duty to the prosecutorial team. Did I say that right? No, he was the defense attorney.
Right, supposedly.
Yeah, but all of his actions said that he was part of the prosecutorial team. Let's go to the phones, Cliff.
All right. On the phones, we have Michelle. Michelle, are you with us?
Welcome to the program, Michelle.
Yes.
What's your question or comment?
Thank you. I know about this case, and what bothers me is that why would she lie? I mean, they accused her of lying about her own account. She can do whatever she wants with it. If she wanted to withdraw the money and blow it to the four winds, it was up to her. And what troubles me is the fact that they're trying to make these trumped-up charges, and the jury never looks at the fact, why would she lie? What would she gain from it? it was her account to do with what she wanted. She had proof that her sister was on the account and do it and make the withdrawal. So some of this is common sense, and it shows to me how judges and prosecutors manipulate the system. She had nothing to gain from lying.
That's right.
And so, and I read the article recently about a judge who was actually texting the prosecutor
right,
to try to help them win their case.
That was Judge Colbert.
And I'm thinking, yeah, and it's like where the system is so screwed up that the family comes and tells the judge, listen, even with the fact that she had proof that her sister was on the account and what she said made sense, to have a handwriting expert have proof sitting in your hand and the judge won't even look at it, won't acknowledge it or do anything, this is sick. They talk about that our system is the best in the world, then we are all screwed. Every one of us.
Absolutely.
Because
Absolutely. Stuff
like this, stuff like this makes me sick. I don't trust the judicial – I don't call it a justice system, the judicial system at all. It is so broken that you can convict someone for lying about something that doesn't even make sense.
Yes,
this
and when I think
this
about
– Go ahead, Luana.
Yes, Michelle, and when I think about that you can live your life – with upholding the law in every aspect, except having traffic tickets. I had quite a few traffic tickets, but at this point I haven't had them in quite a few years. But the thing is, it is amazing that you can live your life and still. That's why people have to look at the fact you still, if they decide I want to come after you, they come after you. Something has to be done about them just deciding I'm going to take you down and trump up charges on you that have no legitimacy or any basis to it. They just dug up something out the blue. I'm going to come up with these. You told three lies, and I didn't lie about anything. I didn't lie about one, two, or three.
And you know, Luana, one of the things that Michelle, the point that she made as far as, well, what do you have to gain by getting before the jury
right.
and in the court to lie? You had nothing to gain. And when you really look at it, it has nothing to do with any of that. It
yes.
has everything to do with Kirsch and the rest of those folks that were all involved in this whole
yes,
thing.
We're going to flip these guys.
Exactly.
Get an innocent bystander, one of their family members.
That's right.
And scare them to death that we're going to put somebody that probably could never survive prison.
Yes.
Well, I got news for you. I survived.
Hey, and you know, it goes back also to what that attorney's name was Goodread. That was Kendrick's attorney who made that comment. And he said that it doesn't matter if there is evidence to exonerate Luana, she's going to do some jail time. Well, back to Michelle's point, you know, what did you have to gain by lying? I can envision somebody in a hallway or in some office somewhere saying, well, it doesn't matter if she's telling the truth. It doesn't matter if she's if she lied or not. It doesn't matter if she's telling the truth. We're going to convict her. You know, that's the only way you can see this thing playing out. I mean, how could your defense attorney, you know, not represent you?
Exactly.
Now, and you know, one of the things too, Luana, is that going back to how he was retained, okay, you were paying for him at first.
Yes.
And then it got to the point, okay, well, we're going to have to go with a court-appointed attorney.
Yes.
He basically said, no, let me stay on.
Yeah, he was so nice.
Oh.
Luana, don't do that. I don't want you to have to get another attorney that really doesn't know all the ins and outs of this case. I will do it for you, which I said, well, that's very nice of you.
I will
but
do it.
That was an ulterior motive.
To you.
Oh, yeah. It was, he had got together
with his
so-called friend,
that's
Matt Kirsch, and they decided, no, we got to keep you on here
that's
so we can make sure
Cliff,
to put you in there.
What's some of the background? I mean, because they teach classes or something
like
that together. And
they teach.
And, you know, we know that, you know, it's a fraternity, so to speak. You know, attorneys are part of all the, you know, of a professional fraternity, so to speak, and especially in this market. But they are like, they got some things going on out there.
They basically have this group of attorneys that teach, you know, sometimes on a voluntary basis, sometimes, you know, just going and speaking in front of other attorneys. They have all these different functions that they go to, and we found out, like, oh, they go together. They teach higher education together. They go to these different functions together. They're buddy-buddy. They rub shoulders. These two men are friends.
And the thing is, no one is opposed to you being in the same profession and that you're going to run into each other and you may be at the same function and you might even go and play golf together or something like that. But when you're on one side of the aisle as a prosecutor,
that's
and
right.
when you're on the, and you got someone else on the other side as far as a defense attorney,
that's
when you
right.
step into that courtroom,
yes.
it's adversarial. It's exactly. supposed to be adversarial.
Yes. And you hook up with the man to do
exactly.
the wrong for somebody.
And it's showing right there in the courtroom that, hey, we're buddy-buddy. And then, you know, God, when you went to the one hearing and he, Kornfeld, was sitting with
yes.
Kirsch.
With Kirsch at the appellate. Yeah.
Smiling and laughing and talking and slapping each other on the back.
I mean, that is just, I mean, that,
yeah, like,
that, that's
like,
the
hey,
kind of stuff.
Like,
that,
we got her, buddy.
See, they got me throwing my pen down now. Got me throwing stuff across the room. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, information about judicial injustice. The phone number, if you'd like to join in, we have also on the phones Judith Housley, board-certified forensic document examiner. And we're talking about the LaWanna Clark case, 347-205-9620. We'll be right back.
Can you imagine spending 20 years of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit? Neither could I until I got the opportunity to portray Betty Ann Waters in the film Conviction, telling the real story of how she freed her brother Kenny. Sadly, what happened to Kenny happens far more often than you might expect. But together, we can stop it. Please join me in helping the Innocence Project fight injustice. Go to InnocenceProject.org to make a donation and get involved.
No justice, no peace. One injustice must be here. Free here. Free
Just Cause Coast to Coast, I'm Sam Thurman, joined by Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. That was Larry Gates, the son of Roger Trotman, singing another song about the IRP 6. You know, we've got a lot of folks writing songs and poems and books and all kinds of things going on right now. And, you know, it's all about bringing the IRP 6 home and bringing them home as soon as possible. We've got all kinds of things going on in the appellate process. We have things going on as far as lawsuits and so forth. So, you know, folks can find out more information about it, Just Cause, at www.a-justcause.com. And more information about the IRP6 case at freetheirp6, freetheirp6.org. Again, that's freetheirp6.org. You can follow us on Twitter, and I guess the proper way to say it is like us on Facebook. We also, in the studio, we have LaWanna Clark. We're talking about the LaWanna Clark case. And then on the phones, we have Judith Housley, board-certified forensic document examiner. And we've been talking about how LaWanna's case is tied into the IRP 6 case. And Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch was trying to basically force the IRP 6 guys to confess to something that they didn't do. And he did it at the expense of your freedom, LaWanna.
That's right.
Now, in March of 2010, and Judith, you're still on the phones there. You can jump in at any time. But in March of 2010, LaWanna, you showed up at federal prison.
Yes.
And I know that was something that was gut-wrenching. It was heartbreaking. And a lot of people, your family, were impacted by that. And then, you know, especially after you have something like, you know, you have Judith Housley, a board-certified forensic document
yes.
examiner, to have the evidence there to prove your innocence,
yes.
and your defense attorney did not use it to help get you exonerated. So, Juana, when you got the news that you were going to have to report, I mean, what was that like?
I was at home that evening. Was it after Christmas? Yeah, I think it was after Christmas. And when I saw the letter that said, I saw the letter that had the Bureau of Prisons on it. And God, I didn't think I still was feeling this. And I just looked at it and held it in my hands, and I opened it, and it said to report March 1st. I didn't even want to tell my mother, or I wanted to act like it didn't really happen. I was hoping never to see it, and when I did, I had to tell my mom. I think I told her the next morning that, Mom, I got the letter to report, and she just said, well, we're going to fight. You're not going to prison. But we're going to do what we have to do. And we did do what we had to do. But after all that, it still came to naught, because these people were determined to put me in prison. I remember when I first got there, sitting in this room waiting for the chaplain to come in, after my brother and sister had dropped me off, and I sat there and I looked up to God and I said, I gotta be strong. You gotta help me to be strong, because I have to stand up the way my mother taught me all my life. And this was a very difficult time. I really feel like I only got through it because God was with me.
Right.
To be out of church, to be away from friends and family, I couldn't call them the first night. That bothered me really bad. I saw so much wrong being in that prison camp with these ladies, and so many of them that shouldn't have been there. And I got to know so many ladies. I was very loved and respected while I was there, but you see so much of the injustice. You see the unfairness. You see the abuse and the pressure that's put on these ladies. I mean, it's cruel things that you'd be thinking, why would you do such a thing? Why would you get people up in the middle of the night and tell them to get outside in the yard, and because we got to look through this and look? And there was nothing they were looking for. It was all about, we just want, once you get here, we want to oppress you and abuse you and mistreat you and try to take away any kind of dignity that you had, that you have at all.
And you know what stinks about this is the fact that you got people like Kirsch and Cornfell, Arguello. They're playing with people's lives, and they were playing with your life. You got Ms. Housley, who stepped up, and again, you know, as Judith said earlier, she didn't know you. She didn't know anything about this case. And, you know, she did her job.
Yes.
As far as, you know, proving that you were innocent. And then when you have a defense attorney who did not present it, and then you have a prosecutor who is dead set on sending somebody to prison, and you got a judge that's not being impartial and being the referee, as Cliff likes to say, you know, and then you end up going to prison, being separated from your husband for 6 months. And as we talked about at the beginning of the program, you know, Kirsch and Arguello would not allow witnesses to talk about your character, but we can hear.
Yes.
And we know that you are a person, like I said before, that would give your last to someone. You would prefer that other people are happy, and you like to see people happy. I mean, you know, and the thing is, when something like this impacts, and we talk about it all the time, you know, folks who don't experience this kind of thing, they look at it and they say, oh, well, you know, so-and-so went to prison. No, it's not, oh, well, so-and-so went to prison.
Yes,
it's,
right.
Oh, well, so-and-so went to prison and her husband went to prison and her, you know, you don't have kids, but, right. You know, if it's a, let's say the IRP 6.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, okay, so David went to prison.
Yeah.
Gary went to prison. Demetrius, Clint, Kendrick, Dave. It's not just those guys went to prison. It's that their wives went to prison.
Their children.
Their children are in prison.
Their parents.
Their parents are in prison.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and Kirsch, Cornfell, Arguello, if you're listening, if we can get some laws changed,
we're going to do that.
You're going to be in prison.
Exactly, we won't stop until we do get
changed. And, you know, another thing as well, when you're talking about the character thing and where, you know, he's talking about her character and he don't want people to testify as to her character.
He didn't want the truth out.
The same thing with the IRP 6.
He didn't want the truth out there.
Nor with these guys, because he didn't want them talking about their character.
That's
he didn't
right.
want the jury to hear them talk about
that
their
they were
character.
Decent people.
You know,
decent men.
That's
exactly.
right.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's
why they didn't want Judith on the stand.
Exactly.
Because of the fact it's like she brought truth into the picture. It's like,
absolutely.
Here is the truth, folks. You know, this lady didn't do anything.
Anybody with decent character, they are looking at them, you know, you see where the bad character comes from.
Isn't our justice system supposed to be about the truth?
Okay.
Yeah. It's like you are innocent until...
And you said the magic word, supposed to be.
Yeah, Cliff.
A lot of cases it is, but in this case it certainly is not.
Cliff, you were trying to make a point.
I was going to say, you know, when you have people that come in and they say, I'm a character witness, I'm going to say, you know, who this person is, how the community is affected by them, how the people who are close are affected by them. You know, even in IRP 6 case... you know, when the guys started making their opening statements and they started to talk about their character, what they had done about, you know, in the community, how they were veterans, how they reached out, how they went and they volunteered at soup kitchens, how they helped out where they could. You know, Matthew Kirsch objected to that. And he made this statement that it always gets to me because it is so... It's so sickening and it's so stupid that he makes an objection saying, you know, I object to them trying to talk about their character. Their character is not on trial here. There's nothing that we're saying about the character.
You're calling me a criminal.
A crook. You're calling me a criminal. You're saying I committed fraud.
That's my character.
You are assassinating my character.
That's right.
Across the board, but then you say that I do not have the right to make statements about the I've done,
That's right.
who I am as a person, what has been proven about my character, who I am as a family man, as a church member, as a person of the community who is a help, as a role model to other young men. You say your character is not on trial. You're assassinating my character, calling me a criminal, but I can't make a statement in the contrary to it. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of.
Yes, because right. he wants everybody to know, believe what I'm saying, which is a lie. His character should have been attacked.
Exactly. Oh, his character, that's what we're here to do, to say that these people are being proven, are being shown that they're the ones that are crooks. They're the ones who are the conspirators.
No
when
integrity.
You, right. There's no integrity when you allow an innocent person to basically be put up in front of the firing squad, mm-hmm. per se, and say, okay, you're going to go to prison. I'm not going to make an objection on the lies from the prosecutor. I'm not going to present the evidence that's been presented by a forensic scientist. I'm just not going to say anything or do anything that will defend you.
And Judith, let's bring you back in here. We're quickly running out of time here. And, you know, again, we so appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your perspective on this case. Now, and I think Cliff had mentioned to you the other day, you know, that we are going to be working as feverishly as possible along with trying to get the IRP6 exonerated. We got to get Luana's name cleared. And so, you know, and we appreciate the commitment that you've made as far as saying that, you know, whatever we need from you as far as presenting or speaking on the fact that the evidence that you presented would have helped to exonerate Juana's name and that there's no way she should have ever been convicted. So, Judith, give us some closing words as far as, you know, some of the things that you would say, you know, where you can contribute as far as to other folks. And again, we appreciate you contributing as far as your services and to a just cause and when the time comes to help to support Luana even.
I will do everything I can to help her. She has been wrongly convicted. You know, Mr. Cornwell, if he was questioning my credentials, I sent him my curriculum vitae, and all he had to do was call the 100 or so Colorado attorneys that are on there to check me out. But to me, this entire case sounds like a lot of power and control, somebody that has no conscience and no empathy. He didn't care what happened to his client.
That's
and
right.
I find that more than appalling. And whatever you progress in this case or however you progress, I will be there to defend her and to help her because what's happened to her is a travesty of justice. There is
it
no
is.
Justice for her.
Well, Judith, we appreciate it. That's Judith Housley, board-certified forensic document examiner who did the analysis in the Luana Clark case. And, Judith, we appreciate you spending the evening with us and sharing time with us, sharing information about your expertise. And we will definitely be in touch with you. Luana, let's go to – and we've got just a little bit of time left. And, again, we know that this thing, you know, impacted you, your family, your friends, everyone in this room. And, you know, some of the things that kind of difficult to hear sometimes – and folks say, well, she only went to prison for 6 months. It's like, okay, you pack up and take yourself somewhere for 6 months and can't be around your family. And when you came home, the adjustment, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. as far as not knowing where things are and you know, just having that sense of I have to relearn stuff. And,
yeah,
and people don't realize how that can impact a person.
Yeah, I didn't even I was amazed.
I mean, it's still
yeah.
impacting you now. I mean,
yeah.
like you just said.
Yeah, and after 6 months, you knew there would be some, but it's so much change just in 6 months. All I could try to identify with was people that were there for years and years and years. How do you come back and readjust to society and to the world and to life, because everything, I mean, things change in a month. Things change in weeks.
Mm-hmm.
How do you readjust? I remember walking into my home and I'm trying to figure where is this? I was in a confused state because I'm trying to figure, I know where I put everything, but I had lost track of where my even in my own home, I didn't know exactly where and what. And then even when I was driving, I always had a problem sometimes driving anyway, getting lost. But this was, I was in a confused, places where I had been all the time. And just in that period, I could not remember where some place was or where this particular address was or
right.
something. It was very difficult. It's very trying to the, it's amazing how much you lose. So I, only thing I could think was how in the world do people come out after a long time and then try to regroup and your emotions and your feelings and you, everything has to be reassessed and reconnected with. And it's just, it was very difficult. I feel for anybody, especially even more so when you should never have gone through it.
Exactly. You know, one of the things I know just by knowing you as the individual that you are, as you were wrongly incarcerated during that time of wrongful incarceration, you know, I have to know that when the ladies, other ladies saw you come in, that, you know, some of them said, well, what are you doing here?
Oh, I got that the entire time.
But you had to have been a positive influence to them. I'm sure that they drew strength from you.
Yes, because of the way I was raised and taught, and because I know God was a part of my life. I would sing sometimes. I would talk to the girls. They would come to me about different scriptures. They would ask me questions. They would. I was always willing to, because I always loved to give, and I was willing to give and give and give and to help. And so many of the ladies, when I got ready to leave, I felt so sad for them because they would lay up on me and just cry and say, Ms. Clark, what are we going to do without you here? They called me Ms. Clark the entire time, which I tried to get them to call me by my first name, but that didn't work. But
well, that was a sign of respect.
Yes,
I mean, you know,
yes,
they
was.
Knew that you weren't a criminal.
Yes, and like, I told them about this whole case. I told them what happened, and people were in shock. They were just like, I can't believe this. And some of the stories I heard from them, they said, I never did anything. I mean, they just pulled me in and said, well, you picked up the phone and said hello, so you had to be a part of your son's crime. Or
yeah.
They put you in prison,
and,
too.
And you know, that is so crazy. I, you know, we've seen stories of grandmothers.
Yes.
I think there was there a couple of grandmothers at
there
your prison?
There were a lot of.
Because
60s and 70s and 80s, I'm thinking.
All because their grandson,
yes,
was running drugs through their house that they didn't know anything about. And then the prosecutor rings them up in it as well.
Right,
yeah,
calls them an exception.
Automatically. And you don't even know. You don't just assume. If your son or daughter does something, doesn't mean you did it.
That's right. And, you know, that's just like, Cliff, we were reviewing the indictment of the IRP-6. And the way that they crafted that thing.
Right.
I mean, it's like you sent a letter to this staffing company giving information about IRP Solutions. Therefore, that constitutes mail fraud. No, I sent a letter that said, you know, this is what my company is, and it is truthful that this is, I mean, everything's proved out. That IRP was a legitimate business developing,
yes,
viable software. Okay, so you send an email to someone. You received an email from someone. You sent a fax to someone. You received a fax from someone. And you put that in an indictment.
That
well, if that's the case, the whole United States would be in prison
and,
then.
And then they stand before a grand jury, and they stand before the grand jury, and then they say, it is your duty, because this little piece of thing right here fits our definition of a crime. You have to indict. I guarantee you that's what happens.
And you know, right, they always, I've heard over and over again, when they have nothing, they use mail or wire.
Right. That's
yeah,
their throw it up against the wall and see what sticks charge. Mail fraud and wire fraud. Just like Sam said, you did this. You sent this company an email saying you want to do business with them. That does not constitute a crime.
It does
that
not at all.
Constitutes. I'm trying to do business with you. But they take that and say, because you sent that email, that's wire fraud.
And you know what, Cliff? And I think you're more familiar with this other case than I am, but Judge Arguello, now she tells the IRP 6 that you were being overly optimistic about your business, and that you were saying that your business did this, 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 and this. And then she ridiculed them for basically saying that I have a good business going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm developing a serious software, and I'm out here marketing it. Now, she ridiculed them for that. And
right,
she basically said that you know, she all but allowed that to be a little bit of the foundation for saying that they were guilty. And I say the judge says that they were guilty because we all know the role she played.
Right.
The jury should have been the ones really making the decision, but Judge Arguello was, like, all over the place. But then in another case in Denver, a company was doing the same thing and saying, hey, our business is good. And that company lost millions of dollars.
They lost millions of dollars.
And she said it's not a crime for you to.
And she says you can't base the fact that a person was optimistic about
their
company, their business, that does not constitute a crime. Well, how do you make that statement in one case
exactly,
and you totally contradict yourself in another? That is why these judges and prosecutors need to be held accountable. They need to be, if you're going to uphold the law across the board.
And but you know what, Cliff, that just even more so points to the stinky part of that. I didn't have another word. But the stinky part of this thing as far as how she treated the IRP6, how she treated LaWanna. I mean, it makes no sense.
Exactly.
And so do we have a caller? We don't? Okay. All right, LaWanna, we are about 5 minutes left into the program. And so, you know, give us some closing words. And, you know, we appreciate you being here and,
sharing your story.
And go ahead, Cliff.
We know that you want to, you know, at least on the air, I'm sure that you've told Judith how you feel, how much you appreciate her coming on. But for those who haven't been privy to the conversations that you've had with her, you know, in the last few days, what would you like to say, Judith, that you want the whole internet to know about?
LaWanna to Judith.
Right, LaWanna to Judith.
Yeah.
Judith, I don't have the words. I don't have the words to say how much I appreciate your concern and your passion for me and for this case and for being willing to be put out and to be a part of helping to right a wrong. I don't have the words. I've never met you, but you seem like such a wonderful person of character, of integrity, of just a beautiful, beautiful woman. I'm sure from inside and out. I just thank you from the bottom of my heart. I will never have the words to say how much I appreciate all that you have said and done, and how you worked so diligently and did and went through all those handwriting things and doing that. That's a lot. And I think your professionalism and everything about you is just beautiful. It's something to be admired.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I think in my life I've always been an advocate for justice. Mm-hmm. I see things that are wrong, and I'm just compelled to try and make them right. I have a case in Arizona. It's similar to yours, but it's not. But the judge would not listen, and the defense attorney didn't do his job, and I'm still trying to help this man. And I will be there for you until this is resolved, because it's heartbreaking to me that a defense attorney and our own judicial system let you down. I think that's horrible. I think most cases are honest, and they try them fairly, but occasionally one slips by, and it should not be ignored. So I do appreciate being on the program, and I'm there for you forever.
Thank you, Judith. I'll be glad when I can meet you face-to-face.
Judith Housley,
board certified. One of these days we can.
Okay.
Thanks, Judith. Judith Housley, board certified forensic document examiner. Thanks for hanging out with us this evening, Judith. LaWanna Clark, thank you for being in the program tonight
and sharing your
story. And so we can bring people aware and make them aware of this type of thing. And like you made the comment, we normally make the comment, but you made the comment that if you're not careful, this same thing can happen to you.
Yes, it can.
And so, but that's what A Just Cause is all about. That's what A Just Cause Coast to Coast is about, where we bring education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. You can find out more information about the IRP6 at freetheirp6.org. Find out more information about A Just Cause at www.a-justcause.com. You can also reach A Just Cause at 855-529-4252. 855-529-4252. That's a toll-free number. Ethel, Eric Holder's number. We're going to keep calling him.
Yes, we want to keep calling Eric Holder at 202-514-2003. Again, that's 202-514-2003 or 2005. Call him. All you got to say is, check into the IRP6 case.
The latest press releases about the IRP6 case can be found at prweb.com. Prweb.com. Put in the search window IRP6. Also, anyone out there listening, Mr. Holder, you're in deep water there. GOP coming after you. So, you know, do the right thing, man. I mean, you know, in there, get some good press. Get an investigation kicked off about the IRP6. But if anyone else out there is listening, you know, give Mr. Holder a call and say, hey, there's this case you need to look into. It's called the IRP6 case. Mr. Holder, you can give us a call as well at 855-529-4252. 855-529-4252 is the Just Cause phone number. Cliff.
All right. We want to say thank you to our production crew, K&D Productions, Dustin Jackson on the boards, and Captain Kyle in the background. We also got Ill Skillers Girl handling the full project management. To the Just Cause Coast to Coast production support crew, couldn't do it without you. To all those out in the chat room, thank you for being with us tonight. We appreciate all your comments and all your questions. Want to say thanks for joining us.
Scott Osborne, Contending for Truth Radio. Scott, hey, hello. Shout out to you. Tell Don Miller we said hello. Folks, listen in on Blog Talk Radio. Tune in and find out a little bit more information about Don Miller. Look under Free Don Miller, because that's another case that's just over the top, y'all. I mean, you know, that is just an atrocious situation as well. But anyway, America, thanks for joining us right here on a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we do education, awareness, information about judicial injustice. Good night, America.
Good night,
y'all. Good night, America, wherever you
pray
are.
For justice.